Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Inauguration's over. The work begins. Spanking brand new President Obama was ready to draw the challenges and talk time in his inaugural address yesterday.
Today, I say to you that the challenges we face are real. They are serious and they are many. They will not be met easily or in a short span of time. But know this, America, they will be met.
Presidents hate to talk about the first 100 days. It's always too fast. The challenges are always too great, especially this time. But the world is watching and waiting already. This hour, On Point, Obama's agenda right out of the gate, the first 100 days and beyond. We've got a great roundtable with us today as Washington restarts after inauguration fever. Jonathan Alter is with us, senior editor and columnist for Newsweek. He's been in the thick of covering the Obama transition and is author of the 2006 bestseller, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. Jonathan Alter, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you. And with us, Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. He writes the presidency column at usnews.com and is all over the new team and its plans. Ken Walsh, welcome back to you as well.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
Let's jump right in with a little review here. FDR, his first inaugural address, the height of the Great Depression, said he had a mandate to move quickly.
This nation is asking for action, and action now. Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war.
FDR, first inaugural, not exactly 1.5 million people applauding there, but you hear him. To treat it as we would the emergency of war in his first inaugural, JFK laid out an ambitious agenda on tyranny and world peace, but warned it would not be easy or quick.
All this will not be finished in the first 100 days, nor will it be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But let us begin.
But let us begin. Perhaps not in our lifetime will it all be addressed. Okay, we'll get to Obama's agenda. He laid it out pretty well yesterday with a litany of the troubles America now faces.
That we are in the midst of crisis is now well understood. Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age. Homes have been lost, jobs shed, businesses shutter. Our health care is too costly, our schools fail too many, and each day brings further evidence that the ways we use energy strengthen our adversaries and threaten our planet.
Obama, yesterday, President Obama on the Capitol, looking over that vast crowd. Jonathan Alter, here we are, day one. You know well presidents don't like to talk first 100 days, but you've written that Obama's team indeed does have a first 100-day plan. We just don't know it because they're disciplined. What may be in there? What do we know?
Well, I think what we do know is they don't like the 100-day frame, Tom, any more than John F. Kennedy did. He certainly gave himself a lot of time to get his agenda accomplished
right.
In our lifetime on the planet. But they are really more focused on getting the so-called stimulus package, what they call the recovery plan, through by the President's Day recess in mid-February. And then sort of make some down payments on other changes to come, both in that bill and in smaller bills, for instance, one that just passed the House on extending children's health insurance, then tackle their big energy and health care packages and try to get them done by the August recess. So they're really giving themselves about 8 months rather than, you know, than 90-100 days.
Ken Walsh, what can you say about the Obama agenda right out of the gate? I mean, Obama may want more time than 100 days, but he couldn't have put the crisis on many fronts that the country is facing in starker terms yesterday. I mean, he's off to the cathedral with Michelle this morning, but then economic and military advisors already in the White House today. David Petraeus back from Afghanistan and Pakistan talking with him. What do you know about the first posts that this administration intends to hit, Ken?
Well, as you say, he's got a church service this morning, but it was interesting to a lot of us in the press corps at the inaugural yesterday noticing that some of his senior advisors sort of vanished and passed up the parade and went to the White House. David Axelrod, one of his senior advisors, Rahm Emanuel, incoming chief of staff, Robert Gibbs, press secretary. And they're going to try to get this first 100 hours into shape here so that they can have some announcements. I think what Jonathan said is completely true about the longer-range 8-month strategy. But in the immediate moments here, what we're expecting, in the press corps at least, is him to name George Mitchell, the former senator from Maine and a negotiator of the Irish peace accords some time ago, to be a Middle East envoy that will be announced very quickly. Almost immediately after Hillary Clinton is confirmed as Secretary of State, which we're expecting today, issuing an executive order to shut down Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, the terrorist the detention facility there. Now, the executive order will be issued, but closing it down will take a while. But he'll sort of get that sort of safety valve established that he's going to close it down eventually, which he promised to do. And then a variety of other things, an executive order probably on abortion counseling, reversing a Bush policy that limited abortion counseling, federal aid to organizations that do that. So you're going to see a number of unilateral actions from President Obama today and tomorrow to show that he's moving quickly. I think that that the polling I've seen, it's very interesting that people realize that we're in a crisis in many ways, including on the economy, but there's more patience, I think, than people might have expected from the public, realizing that this is going to take a while. So I think he has some breathing room, particularly on this stimulus package, and I think that they're looking also at this address to a joint session of Congress the week of February 23rd to sort of as a bookend between the inaugural and when they hope to have this package at least voted on, at least in one chamber in the Congress. So they have this really planned out. They're very methodical planners, and I think you're going to see that in the next 100 hours, really.
Jonathan, the public may be patient, but the markets clearly already yesterday were not. A huge drop again on Wall Street, even as Obama was speaking and the parade rolled on by. It's not just polls and public opinion that are driving the timetable here. The economic side of this equation is just as urgent and at the country's throat as it could be, Jonathan.
Well, and that's why this whirlwind of activity will continue for a while. You heard Franklin Roosevelt talk about how we need action and action now, and Barack Obama, both in his inaugural address and in several recent speeches, has talked repeatedly about the need for action. So they will show a sense of movement, of at least addressing the crisis, even if they can't immediately solve it. Most folks assume, including those in the Obama administration, that things are going to get worse before they get better. And they are going to try to depend on what Ken referred to, which are polls showing a real sense of patience on the part of the public, which is not going to be demanding immediate results. A bigger challenge for them is whether the recovery package will work or not.
Mm-hmm.
Can they, you know, get enough spending going to forestall us slipping from a recession into another depression? And that even they don't know. You know, they're quite candid about not having a roadmap, really, to any guarantee that any of this is necessarily going to work. And there's some indications that some of what's in the package right now, the spending will be rather slow, even though they say it's for so-called shovel-ready projects. A lot of the money can't be spent on roads and bridges for several years yet.
Ken, between the TARP spending we've all heard about and more to come, and the stimulus, we're talking $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion a year. That makes it sound as though the first 100 days indeed will be in no small part just about how fast they can shovel money out the door and try and get into the economy.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, it's an interesting dynamic because the pollsters will tell you that, you know, people are sort of taken aback by these numbers that are thrown around by the economists, you know, $1 trillion recovery plan and so on. But what people are most interested in is that one job that they have, and they're interested in the job situation. So if they can get that fixed, I think that the concern about the deficit and red ink from on the federal government is not nearly as important to people as this job issue. And you saw Obama talk about that in the inaugural address. So I think that they're on the right track there. That's certainly where public opinion is. I think whether they can get that done with all this spending, there's the argument about spending versus tax cuts. But he's going to try to have a combination of both to bring some Republicans in on this thing. I think there's no doubt that the American public, for the public, jobs is really the first objective here.
Tom Asbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about Obama's agenda right out of the gate, as in President Obama. Now, the first 100 days and beyond. Jonathan Alter, I wish you'd kind of set the bar for us. If FDR is indeed, you tell us, the gold standard for her first 100 days action, what does that look like? What does it look like to expect sort of a maximum push from a new president?
Well, what FDR called bold, persistent experimentation, that was the watchword of the New Deal, to throw a lot of things against the wall and see what stuck. There were 15 major pieces of legislation in FDR's first 100 days. Nowadays, we tend to have more kind of what they call omnibus bills, where a lot of things are thrown into one bill. So It's not likely that there will be 15 big signing ceremonies. But in many ways, Obama is being more aggressive than FDR was in his first 100 days, spending more money. FDR actually cut the budget by 30%. He was trying to show fiscal responsibility in the short term because They were still in the grip of of the 1920s ideology, or you could say the 2001 to 2009 ideology.
Right.
So they were kind of more in transition toward Keynesian economics. In our case, we've moved with a vengeance back toward Keynesian spending, and even Ronald Reagan's economist, Martin Feldstein, as well as John McCain's economist, Mark Zandi, are saying that Obama is on the right track in shoveling a lot of money out the door real fast. So I think you're going to see just a flurry of activity. They understand the Roosevelt lesson, are actually, for my selfish purposes, but I think also for the good of the country, very curious about the way Roosevelt did it, and are studying his various not just his programs but his communication strategy with those famous first fireside chats.
Obama intending to be on the television a lot in these early months, we're told.
Roosevelt started holding two press conferences a week. You may remember that during the transition, at one point, Obama held 5 press conferences in a week. Mm-hmm. He's not likely to do that, but you are going to see him more accessible to the press, but likely in a more controlled way. You noticed how in those press conferences during the transition, he planned in advance which reporters he would call on, and he limited the questions to only 5 or 6 in any one session. So they'll be accessible, but more on their terms.
Methodical, always planned, it seems. How aggressive may be the question. We've got a lot more questions, but callers as well. Let's go to Diana in Winchester, Massachusetts. Diana, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to say just that what I've expected from Obama, he started right off the bat during his transition. He gathered the biggest brains around to start working on the economy right away. And I would just hope sincerely that the public is patient with him for the extraordinary magnitude of problems he's facing. He is so clearly the man for these times, and he's head and shoulders above anyone else who wanted to be president this time. And I just feel like we're really lucky to have him, and we have an actual leader again.
Diana, we hear it. So there's the glow and the willingness to show some patience, and yet the problems are urgent. Obama said so himself. Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Chance. Chance, you're on the air.
Hello, how you doing?
Well, what's top of your agenda, Chance?
I'm hoping that they focus on the way that people structure loans for, say, for instance, purchasing a home. I think that it's on a person that can't afford to pay cash, say, for a $100,000 house,
yep,
that it's very unfair to finance a house, and at the end of your loan payments, you're paying four times what the original value of the house is, whereas a rich person can pay for the house $100,000, and he pays just a small amount. I think they need to restructure the way they finance loans for houses and cars.
So restructure, and of course there's a big howl out there for help on the foreclosure front as well.
Tom, well,
yes?
Yeah, I was just going to say on that point, this to me is going to be front and center, and I'm really glad that the caller brought it up. You have a situation where the banks have received billions and billions of dollars, and I think a lot of Americans are asking, if it's good enough for greedy banks, why shouldn't it be good enough for needy homeowners and others who have, are suffering suffering these loans that are ballooning out of their control? So I do think you're going to see them move very quickly, as Franklin Roosevelt did very, very quickly, to avoid foreclosures, and if not to give everybody who's in trouble a fixed rate, at least to adjust things so that we don't see millions of people thrown out of their homes.
Chance, in Augusta, Georgia, it sounds like there may be action on the front where you're concerned. Let's go to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Jenny. Jenny, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just was hoping that President Obama will ask Americans to do something specific and maybe give us a whole list of things, whether it's changing out our light bulbs or cooking food for friends who have lost their jobs. I think, he was sort of mocked for that during the campaign, but Americans are so supportive of him right now that I think we just really want him to tell us, what should we do with specifics.
Right. There was a big call yesterday from Obama in the inauguration saying we're all in this together, and you're not the first person, Jenny, who said to us, well, okay, we're ready. Exactly what will it be? Thanks for that. Let's go to Washington, D.C. also, and Ezra Klein, who joins us there, associate editor and blogger for the American Prospect magazine. Ezra, thanks for being with us.
How you doing, Tom?
We're well. You've got a progressive agenda in Obama's first announcements, first steps, the first glimpses of the agenda that's unfolding in front of us. Do you see what you came to this party for emerging, Ezra?
I don't think anybody came to this party expecting what is emerging, right? Nobody came to the party thinking what we would need to do is extremely rapidly put together a stimulus package approaching $1 trillion. And I think that, to be honest about it, that he's doing, exactly what he needs to do on that, but it's dangerous, right? Because for a moment here, the laws of budgetary reality have lifted. Suddenly, you don't have to worry about how much you spend.
Just open the spigots. Even Reagan-era Reagan economists are saying that.
But what that means is that in 2 or 3 years, those laws come crashing back down with twice the force, probably. And there's not going to be a whole lot of money to spend. And so I think that a lot of folks are worried. I'm worried that you're going to do a lot of spending quickly, which means a lot of it, people will do their best, but only so much is shovel ready, as they say, right? Only so many projects are ready to go tomorrow. And a lot more of those projects are highways than high speed rail. And that in 2 years, when we need to sort of keep building and keep doing a lot of this work, there won't be money for it. But fundamentally, I think that the big concern people had about Obama, that he wouldn't think big enough, is being allayed. And I think you saw it in the speech yesterday. There was a sort of an unrelenting pessimism to it, right? That you almost got in the beginning as he talked about gathering clouds and raging storms. Mm-hmm. It sounded like our cities were on fire and we were, you know, eating rats in the streets to survive. But there was a political theory to that, which came a little bit later in the speech. And what I do think was a key part when he said that there are those who question the scale of our plans. And what they don't understand is the ground has shifted, that this is no time for small thinking, for incrementalism. And that, I think, is very encouraging, because when you're looking at a president, and we're looking at a Democratic president in particular, there is often a fear of bigness, which means that they can be competent, but they can't be great. And I think Obama is making a play for greatness.
Ken Walsh, how about it? Here's Obama. He did talk in very large terms yesterday and certainly braced the country for hard times. A lot of hard stuff going on already. He wants a new politics. He wants a middle way. Ezra Klein and other progressive bloggers are going to have certain expectations. Republicans so far are talking on board with Obama. But can he keep that up as he pushes, you know, the nuts and bolts of a real agenda forward, Ken?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One is I think that at some point he's going to have to, I think, understand that, you know, conciliation goes so far, and he's going to have to sort of show that he's a fighter on some things. He's going to have to, you know, show what's the bottom line. What are you going to take on your critics about? I think that's one question I think we have not answered yet. But also, I think, you know, you saw this in some of the callers already. There's this tremendous desire of people to sort of participate in this whole process here. And they're really jumping on that very quickly. I think you will see him, as the caller asked, to, you know, give us some things we can do. And that was a big criticism of President Bush after 9/11, that he didn't, you know, push the country toward or lead the country toward sort of a movement of national service or sacrifice. He, you know, as his critics like to say, he asked us to go shopping, and that wasn't enough. And then the other point is, there's some little resonance here troubling for Obama, that maybe he's being too pessimistic. There's sort of a Jimmy Carter malaise feel to some of the things he said, almost blaming the country for the sour mood rather than blaming the leadership of the country. The difference between Carter's approach and Reagan's approach. Reagan saying, it's not your fault, Americans, it's the leadership you had. And I think there was a little bit too much of a touch, perhaps, of that notion that Americans, you know, really have dug themselves into this hole. It was brief, but I think a lot of Republicans at least hooked on to that.
Maybe too much, but on the other hand, some feeling of relief at getting real right across the board. Jonathan Alter, Jenny in Cedar Rapids is asking, okay, what exactly do you want us to do? What do you think that's going to be, Jonathan? Is it get on your congressperson to ask for energy changes, ask for health care changes? Is Jenny really going to want the thing that Obama asks her to push for?
Well, initially, I think there will be some things like, you know, changing your light bulbs and participating in service. You know, the first bill that Ted Kennedy introduced in this Congress was not for health insurance. It was the Serve America Act that he and Orrin Hatch are co-sponsoring. And while there's only a couple hundred million dollars in the stimulus for expanding AmeriCorps, which Obama mentioned last night when he was toasting the youth ball, there's some indications that a much bigger service push, which is included in this Kennedy-Hatch bill, might be in the offing, and that young people in particular might have much greater opportunities, as many as 250,000, to go out and serve their country here at home. So that's one thing. I disagree with Ken on this idea that there's a kind of a Jimmy Carter tone that crept in yesterday. I think that's Republicans grasping for straws. They're so used to being in opposition to liberal Democrats, and they think they can go back to that Jimmy Carter well one more time, and we'll see if it works for them. I have my doubts. I think what that part of the speech was actually a very, very critical call for personal responsibility, and it was saying that the government can't solve all your problems, and that people have to take greater responsibility for their own lives, This was received with particular force within the African-American community, and yesterday a lot of African-American commentators reflected on that portion of the speech in a very positive way. And I think it also was intended to indicate to the public, don't expect Uncle Sam to solve all your problems. It's not realistic. And we have to approach this in a more adult way. The quote from Scriptures, it's time to put away childish things.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this was the core of the speech.
Sounded almost like a Republican line, traditionally.
No, but that is a kind of a misnomer of history to mm-hmm. say that talking about personal responsibility and social responsibility is somehow a Republican idea. That's the function of a cartoon that was drawn of Democrats by Republicans in the last generation.
Let's get a call from Afton, Virginia. And Ned, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a burning desire to suggest that President Obama establish a commission to review the war powers legislation that currently give the President of the United States the authority to use military force. Under President Bush, this power was extended to unprecedented levels. And on September 14, 2001, a law was passed which states that, which authorizes the President, quote, to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001.
Mm-hmm. And off to the races he went.
Well, right. The truth of the matter is that Congress could not have prevented him from going into Iraq anyway. In 2003, he had this authority, and it was up to him to determine what he wanted to do. Now, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it, but there is a lot of history between World War II and today where we have gradually moved power from Congress into the president.
Ned, it's a great subject and a great test case, and I think we've got your angle. Let me pick it up with Ezra Klein. Ezra, let's take this. Right from immediate policy on war, Iraq and Afghanistan, Obama sitting down with top military brass today, we're told, to talk about that. Petraeus in from Afghanistan and Pakistan. He promised 16 months, Obama did, and out of Iraq. But here's, you hear our caller Ned saying, no doubt, okay, but let's take it all the way. Let's be dramatic. Let's deal with the war powers themselves. Do you have that kind of expectation, Ezra Klein, from this president?
You know, I think it's a good question and a trickier one than even the War Powers Act would suggest, right? That forgetting acts passed in decades ago, Bush himself expanded the executive in an almost unprecedented fashion. And this was a major thing for progressives over the past 8 years. It was a major cause to argue that the executive was becoming too powerful, too secretive, too unchecked. Now, the question comes, when the executive is someone you trust, whose power you would like to see exercised, do you still fight as a sort of good governance abstract ideal to roll that back?
I have a feeling our caller Ned would say yes, because
right.
Look where we've just been.
But, you know, I'm both skeptical that Obama will roll it back very far and that progressives will do much to force him. There are certain signal things. Torture is one of them. That's gonna end. But is he going to reduce his own office? It would be surprising to me.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about President Barack Obama's agenda right out of the gate. The first 100 days. Let's get a call from Moline, Illinois. And Tim, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to comment on the call from the president for the social responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that for the past decades or further back, it's always been the same group of Americans that have always picked up the ball on the social responsibility.
What does that mean? Who?
Well, the ones that are responsible, that are the middle class, that are paying their bills, that are getting up and going to work every day, always doing the same thing day in, day out, are the same ones that are volunteering their time to the community, giving to social groups and so forth.
You sound as though they've been taken advantage of. By whom, if they have?
By the entire system, by the entire economic system. We have the very affluent that are able to write off their increased expenses, or to pass it on to the consumer.
Or to make a fortune on Wall Street and then be bailed out by you.
Exactly. And then we have the other side of the coin, where we have the very poor in the United States that are on welfare. And I got to tell you that I've seen over the years that we have people on welfare that are living better than I can afford to live. We have people that are living in 3 or 4 bedroom houses or townhomes that have 2.5 baths that don't work. We're paying for that.
Tim, let us pick it up. Jonathan Alter, Obama talked a lot about the middle class. Here's the middle class. Tim, Moline, Illinois. What do you say to Tim to expect from this president with that range of concerns, Jonathan?
Well, I think they've had a pretty unrelenting focus on the middle class, and there was quite a bit of talk about the middle class in the speech yesterday and appeals to some of these ideas. There was talk about how it was the risk takers and the doers and the people who got up there and rolled up their sleeves who built the country, and the new era of responsibility that he talked about. Now, some of what the caller mentioned is really I think an old argument that might not hold as much water as some people think. Welfare was reformed more than a decade ago, and it's actually not even much of an issue anymore. Now, you could say that Medicaid is. In other words, the form of welfare that we have now is really medical insurance for the poor, which many people in the middle class don't get. And this is an area that we're going to see a lot more attention devoted to, is how do we close a gap that's opened up between the poor and the middle class, where the poor are oftentimes have more access to health coverage than do the middle class. So this is something that you're going to see a lot of discussion on, and I think a lot of appeals to middle class voters, also in terms of doing something about the labor movement, which for a long time was a bulwark of the middle class and has atrophied over the decades. And the question there is one of timing. When will the new administration roll out what they call card check legislation that would make it easier to organize and join unions?
Ezra Klein, do you expect that in the first 100 days on the labor front?
I don't expect them to move quickly on card check. I actually think Obama said as much earlier this week and offered sort of some willingness to compromise, not on moving forward with legislation that would prevent employers from making it virtually impossible to unionize, but with compromising on the principle of how do you do it with card check. I expect the first 100 days to move first on stimulus, and then I think it's going to go to health care. I think that during the campaign, Obama said that it would actually next go to energy, and I think that there's a real case to be made for that. But earlier this week, or earlier last week, actually, mm-hmm. at his confirmation hearings, Peter Orszag, the incoming director of the Office of Management and Budget, mm-hmm. said that the priorities, he didn't quite say the priorities have shifted, but asked what the priorities were and in what order. He said first stimulus, then health care, then energy. And this is the guy who's building the budget. So he'd know. I think that in response to the caller concerned about the middle class, that the Obama administration, interesting to say that now, has judged that this is a moment where the political forces and opportunities are aligning, but in favor not probably of carbon pricing, but of policies and programs that, you know, will do something to really ease the economic anxiety. And I think healthcare fits very neatly into that box for them.
Ken, I mean, those are so huge. Energy, yeah. Healthcare, that you can say them quickly, but they're absolutely right. Massive. In this immediate term, what do you expect on those fronts?
Well, I think you're going to see him touch on some of these things immediately. I think in the next 48 hours, I think, for instance, he'll address fuel efficiency in automobiles in another one of these executive orders or administrative actions. And so, and as we've said, that this S-CHIP program, which would increase coverage of children in health care, that's going to happen rather mm-hmm. quickly. So he's got all these things he's going to touch on. But I think the other thing that he's going to do is he's got this $350 billion, the half of that initial stimulus program that was passed.
Or the bailout,
Bush,
TARP money.
The bailout.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there's a lot of talk in among Obama's advisors to use that for just what we've been talking about, the middle class helping with the foreclosures and with relief for homeowners. So I think you'll see a lot more of that adjusted, and he's got that at his disposal. So that was actually a victory he had before he even became president in persuading recalcitrant legislators, including some Democrats, to go along with giving him that money. He's got it now.
Let me ask about banks. All kinds of bad news in bank stocks yesterday, banks reporting in the U.S. and the U.K., big trouble. Headline in the New York Times, one of our listeners points out at the website, onpointradio.org, Obama has no quick fix for banks. And our correspondent here, David, says, while Obama's top advisors view the black hole in the bank balance sheets as one of the most pressing problems, they cautioned, or quoting the Times here, they wouldn't be pressured into announcing a plan until they had carefully thought it through. And our listener says, why haven't they already thought through all the options? What have they been doing for the last 2 months? Jonathan Alter, fair? Unfair?
Well, first they made some mistakes on TARP. Basically, we have a situation where TARP, the Troubled Assets, I always get the acronym a little bit confused, a recovery program or something
yes.
close to that,
mm-hmm.
Which was the original banking bailout, and ARP, which is the American Recovery and Reinvestment Plan, which is Obama's stimulus, TARP and ARP are eating Washington. And you have a situation where the original policymaking within TARP, which was handled by outgoing, now former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, failed. And they had to amend it
yep.
At least twice, and will probably have to do so again. It's extraordinarily complex. It's been handled badly, as a report from a commission chaired by Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren has proven.
Yes, but the they then, Jonathan, was the Bush administration. So
right.
Now you've got Obama. Do they have a...
Right. And Tim Geithner, the incoming Treasury Secretary, if he can survive his tax...
In price. The hot seat this morning,
right.
Yes.
So he is apparently... the only one in Washington, because he was involved in the original discussions on TARP, who really understands the details and can understand how to fix it, even though he's at least partly implicated in some of the
screw-ups.
Strategies initially. Mm-hmm. So he needs to first fess up that they messed up and then get on with fixing it. That's another thing that Franklin Roosevelt did frequently, mid-course correction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When something in that, when he said we need bold, persistent experimentation, the rest of that famous line was, take a method and try it. If it fails, admit failure frankly. Well, Tom, that's a very novel concept in the Bush era, admitting failure frankly, and try another method. But above all, Roosevelt said, try something. So Obama is going to have to learn how to admit when things aren't working, and then throw something else against the wall.
Here's Treasury Secretary nominee Tim Geithner this morning in his hearing before the Senate Finance Committee talking about exactly that financial crisis.
We now confront extraordinary challenges. A severe recession here and around the world, a catastrophic loss of trust and confidence in our financial system, unprecedented foreclosure rates, small businesses struggling to stay afloat, millions of Americans worried about losing their jobs and their savings. A deep uncertainty about what tomorrow holds.
Ezra Klein, there's the litany again of, whoa, another $350 billionaire there. We've heard it said needs to go to housing, foreclosure problems, but the bank's news just gets worse and worse. Here's another example of choices that will have to be made, and quickly. Can Obama address both the foreclosure, housing side of this, and the continuing fallout in the banking side?
You know, the problems are dizzying on that, right? On the one hand, you have the banks, which are basically dealing with a crisis of confidence. Nobody knows what any individual bank has. Nobody's willing to invest. The whole thing is frozen because there's no real way to guarantee anything. The odd thing about this particular financial crisis is that a lot of what has made it so deep is that it's very opaque. The people who are running it don't know what their assets are, don't know what the foreclosure rate will be. So then you have, on the other side, of course, the anxieties of people. Here is one place where I think the Obama administration has been, and the Obama campaign for that matter, has been insufficiently bold. The only really good example we have of a country, of a developed country, dealing effectively with a financial crisis like this one is Sweden. And what they eventually had to do was temporarily nationalize the banks. They essentially had to say, you guys appear to not be able to work with each other anymore. The only sort of creditor of that people are really confident will remain standing is the federal government, because frankly, if the government goes down, we got bigger problems in our banks. Mm. And they had to do that, and it worked. I mean, there's no argument on this. It worked. And my fear, and I think the fear of many, is that we're going to just keep walking up to that line, and eventually we will cross it. But in the meantime, as we try to do 100 things that are more ideologically appropriate, that aren't quite so radical, and I agree, nationalization is radical, but it's a big crisis, that we're going to spend a lot of money that we don't need to spend, and we're going to allow a lot of economic pain that we don't need to allow. And so this is one place where I think that Obama would do well to read his own speech from yesterday a little bit.
There is another option here, Tom, and that is what they're calling a bank of bad assets. The Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has been talking about, instead of full nationalization, even on a temporary basis, you create a government bank that takes all the bad assets off the books of the other banks. Now, you could say that that is a de facto nationalization, because those banks have so many bad assets.
But by different means.
It's another way of approaching the problem, and one that's gaining currency.
But let me just say on that I think that's the sort of thing that does worry me, because as opposed to nationalization, I actually wouldn't say that that's de facto nationalization. What it is it is de facto socialization of loss, right? That rather than nationalize the banks, we're going to nationalize the consequences of the bank's bad decisions.
But that's happening already. That's happened in the hundreds of billions already. But if you stop it and they go down, don't we all go down? As big as all that is, we're going to have to come back to it, because there's more out there. And Ken Walsh, I want to ask you on the military front.
Right.
There's Petraeus sitting down with Obama today, we're told, and a lot of other military brass. Obama promised 16 months and out from Iraq. And we're told he's going to tell them today, yes, indeed, that's what I want to do. What have you heard, Ken, about how the Pentagon is likely to respond? Is David Petraeus going to salute and, sort of head the troops in that direction, or argue otherwise?
Well, this is another very interesting thicket that Obama is wading into.
To say the least.
He's meeting with the military leaders, including General Petraeus, and from what we're hearing, is going to tell them, we have a new commander-in-chief now, and I want a plan for withdrawal of the combat troops within 16 months. Now, we're not quite sure how they're going to respond. Petraeus, in particular, is the architect of the surge policy in Iraq, and he has a tremendous amount of credibility with both parties and with a lot of Americans. And I think that he has a lot of cards to play here. If he objected or went public with it, I don't know that he would do that, because he is a loyal soldier.
Mm-hmm.
The question is how damaging would that be to Barack Obama's effort here. But you also have Bob Gates, who's staying on as defense secretary, who's also part of this whole process, and he's wedded to the previous policy as well. Now, Obama has said, the commander-in-chief sets the policy, and he's now in charge, and I think you get from some of the people around him, if the generals don't cooperate, he'll do what other presidents have done from Harry Truman on down, Abraham Lincoln, and find generals who will do what he wants. And I think that's the tough line, and that's what I was getting at earlier. He has some bottom lines he has to set here, and this is one that I think we'll know somewhat more about where he is at the end of these meetings with the military leaders, and how far he's going to insist on this. He says he's going to listen to the leaders, which I think some anti-war folks are troubled by, that may back him off this 16-month timetable. But on the other hand, his political advisors say he made such a big point of this in the campaign that he's got to push for it.
He's got to do it. Let's get one more very quick call. David in Norwell, Massachusetts. Our time is extremely short. Make it quick, David. What are you looking at?
Hi. I'm deeply concerned about what I've been hearing on so-called right-wing talk radio. It seems that they're trying to whip up their listeners to almost sabotage what the new administration wants to do. There's a hidden agenda there, it seems, and unlike your show, they don't allow people to comment uninterrupted and without ridicule.
Well, I have to interrupt on the timetable we're on, but I appreciate that, David. Jonathan, what about it? It's been a big force for a long time. It's not going away. I don't know if it's a hidden agenda. There's just an agenda. Is the right a threat to the Obama agenda, or talk show hosts aside, on board at this point, Jonathan?
Well, it's obviously some kind of a threat. Any political opposition is, but I think talk radio in particular, while its ratings will stay strong, right-wing talk radio is a part of America's past, not America's future. They've been marginalized. This force in American politics, which for the last decade or more was considered to be in the center of our politics, is now on the fringes of our politics, and that's a welcome change.
Well, they can go wherever they like. We're rolling forward right here. Jonathan Alter with Newsweek magazine, author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us on this day after Inauguration Day.
Thanks, Tom.
Ken Walsh, it's always great to have you. Chief White House correspondent at U.S. News and World Report, writes the presidency column at usnews.com. Ken, you're terrific. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having me.
And Ezra Klein, I'd like to say welcome to you. Hope you'll come again. Editor and blogger for the American Prospect magazine. Ezra, thanks very much for joining us.
Anytime, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for being here as well. Off we go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.